lightly, though he took care not to express this opinion in Sommerled's hearing. Still, when Ulf told him both he and Sommerled would be travelling on the Knarr, Eivind put up no argument. There was stocked convey, after all, and Eivind was good with animals, being farm-bred. Besides, with 8 oars on the Knarr and a crew of only 10, it was evident that he would be able to make himself useful. Many folk lined the shore to salute their departure, but Signe did not come down. Her farewell to Eivind had been tender and secret, its message conveyed more by touch than by words. It had been strange. It almost seemed to Eivind like a goodbye that was forever. Though he'd assured Signe he would be back in the Awesome. Hadn't he given his word to the Jarl? Even before the sheltered coastal waters gave way to open seas, the folk they carried grew sick. Women staggered to the side to heave their breakfast up. Children failed to do so and spewed forth on whatever was nearest. The crew ignored them completely, save for curt commands to get out of the way when necessary. It was their job to convey the cargo to the islands, not act as nursemaids. The folk huddled in the bows of the Knarr, their small bundles by them. The stock were closer to the stern, tethered to iron rings set in the decking. Ulf's dogs had travelled on the longship, a small mercy. The cargo was loaded below, and beneath it the Knarr bore a ballast of small river rocks. For all that, she rode higher in the water than the Golden Dragon, with its smooth lines and great bank of oars. Eivind had never travelled in a cargo boat, and wondered how they would manage to keep up, burdened with their way-faced complement of non-sailors. But the Knarr surprised him. In open sea, with a following wind, she moved swift and steady as a small neat bird, the square sail carrying her on an easy, stable course. At most, they needed 4 oars, and generally none. The Golden Dragon, by contrast, seemed to be employing both oars and sail to make progress, and it became a challenge not to go too far ahead and lose sight of her. This crew was experienced. They had sailed much farther south than Eivind had ever travelled on Magnus's raids. They had taken a load of walrus tusks and fine furs westward from the Frankish coast, across to a trading centre called Ludenwick. A full day's journey. Still, this voyage was daunting even for them. Nobody liked the idea of nights at sea, and a ship full of puking infants, shivering women, and useless thralls did nothing to improve the prospect. The sounds made a pattern. The ship's timbers creaked as the ocean tested her strength. The water slapped against her sides. The crew sang ribald ditties as they bailed or rowed or worked yard or tiller or whisker pole at the master's shouted commands. Cries as harsh and strange as some great seabird's call. Ah, dup! Ah, done! E-way! All learned to duck and dodge when they heard that, or they might find themselves engulfed in a rolling expanse of wet canvas. And one must stay well clear of the whisker pole, which was used to change the set of the sail, in order to take advantage of even the most contrary wind. As in the longship, the Knarr's tiller was on the starboard side. The tillerman had arms like a blacksmith's, and needed all his strength, for the thing could buck and jerk under the sea's violent surges like some wild creature. The man they called Firehead, who spoke to nobody but his crewmates, appeared to be much valued among these hard-bitten seamen. It was he who assumed control while the ship's master snatched a brief rest. At times he took his own turn on the tiller, and those were the only times when Eivind saw something resembling peace on the fellow's brooding features. Gazing ahead into the dark surge of the swell as he kept the Knarr on her steady course, Firehead's eyes lost their dangerous look, and seemed instead to be seeing something else entirely. Something that was not on the ship or in the ocean, but far away in a place only he could catch sight of. While Eivind took a turn on an oar, and helped calm the frightened stock, and even shared out hard bread and apples among the passengers huddled together on the forward deck, Sommerled also was far from idle. It was not long before one and then another of the crew commented that the Lord Ulf's brother was no mean hand with a line, and could tie a knot as well as any of them. And that it wasn't every nobleman's son who would step up and give a hand, especially when he'd just been sick as a dog over the port railing into the sea. Firehead made no comment at all. When the crewmen rested in turns, Somerled sat among them, listening to their tales of exotic ports and even more exotic women, laughing appreciatively, and putting in a few stories of his own that soon had the men in stitches with laughter. There was a side of Somerled that Eivind had never seen, and it seemed to him something of a miracle, for his friends had ever been aloof and disdainful among working folk. The winds died down before nightfall, which pleased everyone. The sail was lowered, the oars stilled. They dragged an anchor, for here even the longest line would not find the sea's floor. Lanterns were lit at bow and stern, and the men put up a makeshift tent for shelter. Not far off in the fading light, the long, dark form of the golden dragon could be seen riding low in the water, her own lamps tiny points of light which moved crazily against the mysterious, breathing darkness of the ocean. Eivind stood watching as stars emerged in the night sky, one, then two, then a whole great pattern of them from edge to edge of the world. He felt the immensity of that black expanse of water around them, a sea so vast that no land could be sighted in any direction. Not by the man with the best eyes in all of Norway. These ships were so small, so fragile, though they had seemed strong and dauntless on the safe shores of Freyrsfjord. Would not the coming of dawn snuff out each one of those tiny stars that now shone so splendidly in the inky sky above him? Perhaps the same dawn would see the frail craft of Ulf's venture extinguished as well, sunk by a freak wave, overturned by the sudden breaching of a whale, or driven off course by spring gales to splinter on some half-submerged reef. Perhaps their human cargo, leader, warrior, crewman, innocent woman, and infant, would perish one and all, gone as quickly as those small stars that faded in the coming of the light. "We think ourselves so grand," thought Eivind, "so brave and strong. But before this, we are like chaff in the wind, like bubbles on the stream." The thought did not frighten him. He felt only a great sense of calm and of quiet. And he stood there long, gazing out into the deepening night as crew and passengers settled to sleep as best they could. And two men stood watch. The second day brought a thick blanket of cloud. On the Golden Dragon, Ulf could be seen squinting at his sunstones, trying to fix his course. As long as there was the smallest patch of blue somewhere in the sky, a man who had the right skill could catch the sun's light in the crystalline depths of these stones, and use it to help find his way. Ulf had brought ravens as well, but he would not release them yet, for the fleet had not journeyed far enough from Rogaland. The birds would simply turn and fly straight for home. The true test would come in a day or two, if the wind stood fair. Some of the passengers had begun to get their sea legs, and among these was a lively infant of perhaps 3 years old, a sturdy little fellow with a dangerous bent for exploration. His mother was prostrate, retching and moaning. The other folk tried to curb the child, but what with the rocking of the boat and the need to keep out of the crew's way and tend to those who were sick, it was no easy matter. There was a girl, the boy's sister, a fair-haired lass of about 14, sweet-featured and quiet. She hauled the infant back from trouble time after time with soft-voiced reprimands. But it was a bit like ordering the wind not to blow or the tide not to come in. This was a boy who would make a fine sort of man, if the gods let him get that far. Toward midday, the girl was busy tending to her mother, and most of the others were rolled miserably in their damp blankets, trying to shut out a world that had grown suddenly too difficult. Eivind was coaxing the restless castle into sampling grain from a bucket when he spotted the small lad scaling the canal's side to perch precariously astride the rail, a hair's breadth from tumbling over and down to the chill surge of the sea. There was nobody near the boy. The crew were rowing, or steering, or sleeping, and Firehead was in the stern, keeping an eye on the other boat and shouting orders as necessary in that strange seaman's tongue.
"Hard up! E-way!"
The child teetered. The swell rose. Two crewmen moved into position to swing the whisker pole. As soon as they did that, the whole vessel would shudder and shift, and even those lying on deck would need to hold on, not to be tumbled hither and thither. Eivind opened his mouth to shout a warning, but the crewman moved too fast. The whisker pole swung across, shifting the great, crackling sail, and the canard judded and swung after it, obedient to the wind. The boy toppled and fell, and quick as a flash, a man who had been hidden from view because he was leaning over the side, retching the last drops of bile out of his tortured gut, reached to grab one small arm, hooked his own foot under the ledge that skirted the oar ports, strained to haul in his shrieking catch before the wind and the waves snatched the two of them off the boat into a last cold embrace. Eivind sprinted across the slanting, slippery deck, and now others, too, saw Somerled hanging there, his foot jammed under the railing, the only thing that kept him and the boy from the ocean's icy grasp. The wind rose, bearing the child's screams away from his lips, as if they were of no account whatever. Somerled's face was the color of fresh cheese, his jaw was set grim, his hands gripped white-knuckled around the child's arm. He did not have enough purchase to pull the lad to safety, and his foot was beginning to slip now, the boot leather tearing under the strain. "Help me, will you?" he hissed through tight-clenched teeth, as at last Eivind reached his side. Both taller and stronger than Somerled, he had no trouble reaching down to seize the child under the arms and lift him to safety. The boy's screams subsided to hiccuping sobs. His sister, ashen-faced, took him in trembling arms and proceeded to scold him roundly, with tears of fright glinting in her blue eyes.
"All right?"
Eivind inquired as Somerled eased his cramped arms and unhooked his foot with extreme caution, as if it might be hurting quite a lot.
"Yes," said Somerled faintly. "Or maybe no. Excuse me."
And he leaned back over the rail, his stomach heaving anew in protest at the canard's relentless movement. It took a while.
"Perhaps that's all. Until next time,"
Somerled observed, straightening up and wiping his mouth with his sleeve.
"My brother must be crazy. Who'd do this by choice?"
Then he looked up and saw the girl standing before him with the child, now quiet in her arms.
"Thank you," she said, looking at him under her lashes. "You saved his life. Thank you so much."
Somerled appeared quite taken aback, as if he did not think what he had done was in any way remarkable.
"It's nothing,"
he said, reaching out to pat the child rather awkwardly on the arm.
"Don't mention it."
"It didn't seem like nothing to me,"
the girl ventured, her cheeks turning a delicate pink.
"And thank you, too."
She glanced at Eivind and quickly away, as folk sometimes did with his kind.
"And my brother's always getting into trouble," she went on shyly. "I'll try to look after him better. And I'm sorry you're so sick."
Somerled did not reply, but he watched the girl as she made her way back to her mother's side and settled her small brother with bribes of salt fish and wrinkled apples. Then one after another of the crew came forward to clap Somerled on the back and congratulate him for his quick thinking and comment that they'd like to share an ale with him. Only it would hardly be worth it, since he'd be lucky to keep it in his belly long enough to enjoy it. Somerled had become a sort of hero. Firehead did not shake his hand and grin and make friendly jokes. Firehead had not moved from where he stood in the stern of the canard, alone. But he watched with narrowed eyes, and Eivind read the look on his hard features and was uneasy. It was unfortunate, he thought, that Somerled had travelled on the very same craft as this taciturn fellow, who might or might not have once gone by the name Sigurd. Yet if Somerled had been on the Golden Dragon with Ulf and Margaret, that lad would have fallen overboard and drowned. You could never second-guess the gods. Still, Eivind would be glad when they reached their destination and could pay off the canard's crew and get on with things. Maybe Somerled's newfound popularity would set him in better stead with his brother. One could always hope. The weather got rougher, so rough they could not go under sail. They used the oars as best they could to keep within sight of the longship. The passengers grew quieter and the stock noisier. A crewman was heard threatening to wring the gander's neck if it didn't leave off that wretched honking. Avon shoveled cattle dung over the side and tried to ration the grain. He did notice, once or twice, that the fair-haired girl was talking to Somerled quite a bit, and he wondered what the two of them could possibly have in common. Since Somerled was still spending half his time leaning over the sea, retching, he was surely less than an ideal companion. Once Avon saw the girl slip as a wave caught the canard, lifting the bows high, and Somerled's arm came out quickly to steady her. If anything, Avon was pleased by this development. She was a little young, certainly, but if she took Somerled's mind off his brother's wife, that surely had to be good. On the fourth day, Ulf released one of his ravens. The bird circled the fleet and flew off westward. They waited. By nightfall, the creature had not returned, and Ulf conveyed to the other ship by shouts and signs that he was well pleased. It seemed their course was true. Eivind had had little sleep, but he was used to that. A warrior is trained to endure far worse hardships. That night he slumbered lightly for all his weariness, and woke abruptly while it was still pitch dark. He could not identify what he had heard. He only knew it meant danger. Not of the boat. It was moving steadily and slowly, sail reefed, anchor trailing. The folks slept safe under the awning, the stock were mercifully quiet. He could see the fellow on watch in the bow, up beyond the sleeping area. All seemed well. But he had heard it. Eivind got quietly to his feet, and there it was again. Not creaking timbers or snore of man or woman, not moving water or cry of sea creature, but something wrong, something out of place. A hissing gasp, a wheeze of expiring air, a sound born of pain. He moved. A hunter has sharp eyes and sharper ears, something dark by the rail on the port side. Perhaps only someone had been sick again. No, there were two men here, and the one bent over the rail was held there forcibly, pinned down by the other. The red-headed man had a grip on Somerled's hair and was pushing his head downward, crushing his neck against the rail. Somerled's left arm flailed helplessly. His right was twisted up behind his back at an impossible angle. It was his gasp Avon had heard, the sound a man makes when he has not quite enough time to breathe before his throat is constricted once more. And Firehead's fierce whisper, "That's for today, and that's for yesterday, and that's for what you did before." Avon was there in two great strides, grabbing Firehead by the arms. The fellow was strong, his fingers were most reluctant to give up their death-like grip on Somerled's hair. Avon applied a well-practiced technique involving a knee to a particular point in the back, and Firehead gave a grunt of pain and released his hold. Somerled crumpled to the deck, sucking in a strangled, croaking breath. Avon backed Firehead against the canard's rail, holding him fast with a cunning grip on the neck. Firehead had stopped struggling, realizing perhaps that it was pointless when the man who held you was a wolfskin.
"You can let me go," he muttered. "I've no quarrel with you." "What sort of fool are you?" hissed Eivind. "You nearly killed him. Your job's to sail this thing and follow Lord Ulf's orders, not strangle his family. What am I supposed to do with you?"
Cautiously he released his grasp. Firehead stared back at him, his face reduced to a mask of moonlight and shadow in the rocking dark. Beside them, Somerled was getting slowly to his feet. His breathing sounded tight and painful. Firehead spat on the deck.
"I've told you," he said flatly. "But you wouldn't hear me. He's at it again. He'll never change. Haven't you seen him with that girl, the one with the younger brother? But no, you wouldn't notice. You're blinded by the promise you made. You should have let me finish this now."
It was as good as telling them who he was, who he had once been.
"We thought you might be able to put that behind you," Avon said quietly. "Not let it poison your whole life. My mother thought you might have come back. There's always been a place for you at Hammersby. It's your home as much as it is mine and Eirik's. There's no going back."
Firehead's tone was bleak. He turned and walked away, down to his watch in the stern, and the darkness swallowed him.
"Are you all right?"
Eivind whispered to Summerled, who was touching his throat gingerly.
"We'll have to report this to the ship's master. He nearly killed you." "No need," Summerled croaked. "But leave it, Eivind. This will work itself out, trust me." "But Summerled, leave it, will you?"
The next morning, Ulf released a second raven, and they observed its direction before hoisting sails and following after. The wind was strong from the north, there was a relentless swell, and progress was both fast and uncomfortable. All longed for the voyage to be over. As for what had happened the night before, both Firehead and Summerled seemed to have forgotten it. Each behaved as usual, the one occupied with sailing the ship, the other still spending most of his time doubled over the rail. Summerled was no seafarer. Eivind was beginning to relax, thinking that there was not so far to go now, and perhaps they might get there without further trouble, when there was a sudden bellow from the stern of the Knarr, followed by a chorus of shrieks from the passengers. The bull, which had been growing increasingly restless as the days of close confinement and lurching movement went on, had begun to jerk its head about with some violence, snorting and stamping. Two stout ropes tethered the creature to iron rings set in the decking, but it was not hobbled. Such fetters would pose too great a risk of breaking a limb if the ship's movement caused a fall, and this fine animal was to be the foundation of Ulf's breeding herd. Now its angry struggles had broken one of its tethers, leaving only a single length of rope to restrain it. Sensing freedom close, it continued to buck and twist and pull at this last bond, roaring its anger. The heifers raised their voices in support. The sheep, chickens, and geese joined in hysterically, driving the bull to more strenuous efforts. And suddenly, amidst the cacophony of animal noises, there was a sound of splitting timber as the pine decking started to give beneath the onslaught of the creature's hooves. The crewmen backed away, oars abandoned. The women screamed, gathering children in close. Little imagination was required to picture what damage a beast of that size, with those horns, could do to vessel and passengers before it might be checked or leap overboard in its frenzy. The head jerked anew, the horns scythed through the air. Folk cringed. Who could get anywhere near, even supposing anyone were foolish enough to try? They say a wolfskin does not know fear, not as a normal man does. It did not occur to Eivind to stand back. Arming himself with a looped length of rope, he moved in on the crazed bull, holding the tether unobtrusively by his side. He made his progress slow and quiet, balancing each step against the Knarr's movement. On the other side, Firehead was edging in behind the thrashing animal. He had seized a short pole with an iron hook on one end. Because they had done this sort of thing before, catching stock for branding or gelding, there was no need for either man to speak. Each knew his part. Firehead would try to get a purchase on the remaining tether, or the horns, while Eivind moved in to loop the rope on and secure it. They'd need to be quick. The single restraint was starting to give, and the boards beneath the bull's hooves were cracking and splitting. The animal was kicking at random, and the swinging of its head grew ever wilder. Firehead moved closer. He lifted his hook. Eivind stood still, noose now ready in his hand, awaiting the single movement when it might be slipped on safely. The hook would not hold the bull for long. The creature's small eyes moved from one man to the other and back again. Eivind glanced at Firehead, and Firehead gave a little nod. Now.
"Why don't you use a spear and kill the creature?"
The voice was Summerled's, clear and logical.
"That way you can keep your distance and we all stay safe." "Get out of the way, you fool," Eivind snapped,
alarmed that his friend had been foolish enough to come so close. He stood on the opposite side, barely out of reach of those flying hooves. Summerled didn't know a thing about handling stock.
"Let Sigurd get in there. He has to hold the head still while I put this on. If you think I'm stupid enough to slaughter Ulf's stud bull, you're mistaken. Now shut up and let us get on with this."
The creature's eyes narrowed. It lowered its head as if to charge.
"Oh, now. Who now?
Eivind repeated softly, knowing this creature was beyond being reassured thus, but saying it anyway, for at least it kept the bull's attention on him and off the others.
Who now, bonny one?
That fraying rope was the only thing stopping the bull from coming straight at him. There was blind terror in those crazy eyes.
Who now, my bold one?
For an instant the creature held still. This was the moment. Firehead stretched out with the hook. Eivind had the noose in place to slip over the horns. Then everything went mad. There was a furious bellow and a whirl of chaotic movement. Hooves flew, wood splintered. The bull's head swung to the side in a violent jerk that snapped the last tether, and it was free. The great horns swept across this way, that way, and entered Firehead's chest as easily as a knife pierces a ripe pear. Eivind stood frozen in shock as the creature lifted Firehead bodily from the deck, cruelly suspended on that spear of horn. Then, in a single great swing of its head, the bull set its burden free, tossing the red-haired man clean over the Knarr's side and out into the heaving swell of the ocean. Firehead had made no sound at all, save for a grunt of surprise as the horn took him. Death had granted him no chance to tell his story, or call on his gods. He was gone in an eye-blink. The bull pawed the deck and lowered its head again. Its horns were stained bright red, but Eivind's axe was already in his hand. There was no choice now. His single blow struck true, cleaving the skull between the small, furious eyes, and Ulf's best breeding bull fell lifeless on the splintered deck. Its end was as quick as the man's. If Eivind knew anything, it was how to kill cleanly. Once people accepted the bull was really dead, they ran to help. It was too late for Firehead. No man could survive such an injury, even supposing it might be possible to find him in that surging expanse of icy water. While the ship's master maneuvered her close enough to the golden dragon so they could shout across to Ulf, Eivind knelt by the bull's still warm body and carefully extricated his axe from where it was lodged deep in the skull. Biter was a fine weapon. He never let it rust or lose its edge. The axe had saved many lives today. He wished it could have saved Sigurd's, the Firehead's as well. Why had the bull suddenly gone mad like that? He was sure they'd had enough time, certain they could have tethered it safely between the two of them. Now all the creature was fit for was roasting on a spit and being served up for supper. And Eivind would never learn the tale behind Firehead's haunted eyes. He got to his feet, studying the great limp body, and thinking that the open deck of a Knarr, with rain beginning to slant in, was scarcely the ideal spot for cutting joints of meat. He bent over again, looking more closely. He squatted down by the creature's rump. What was this? There was blood here. Not Sigurd's blood, for that was all on the horns and the rail, and sprayed over the inner surface of the strakes. This blood dripped down the inside of the bull's rear legs, and pooled now on the deck beneath its tail. There was a fresh wound there, a slit to the animal's testicles, and it was from this the blood still ran. Though that would stop soon enough. How could such a tidy cut have been inflicted in such a place? Perhaps the bull had damaged itself in its frenzy. Maybe it had gashed the testes on something, a jutting piece of wood, a food trough, anything. What else could this be? Yet the cut was so neat, like a surgeon's incision, and there was no barrel, no protrusion. The stock area was always kept as clear as possible. This was like a knife wound, precise and true. But that could not be. There had been nobody close enough, nobody with the opportunity. Almost nobody. In the back of his mind, Eivind put two things together. A painful jab to the privates, a sudden enraged lunge, breaking the last rope and impaling a man all at once. He knelt by the bull, thinking. Firehead had died, but it might just as easily have been himself or even Somerled. Nobody could have known which way the bull would turn. A risky game indeed. The ship's master was calling. Ulf was responding. He wanted the bulls thrown into the sea, an offering for Freya. They could not afford to have the ill omen of Firehead's death over this voyage. Eivind decided he must be imagining things, for there was no sense to what his mind was telling him. He rose to his feet. There was work to be done.
"Oh dear," said Somerled.
He stood quietly at a little distance, his face gravely composed.
"He seemed quite a useful fellow, too. Still, I expect they'll manage to sail this tub without him. And if these islands provide the lush grazing my brother praises so lavishly, no doubt there will be wild cattle there for the taking."
"He was a friend of mine once," Eivind said, frowning.
It unsettled him when Somerled spoke like this. It was as if he thought nothing in the world of very much account.
"You're a strange creature, Eivind," said Somerled. "Death should be nothing to you. Don't you deliver it 100-fold as your daily business? What does it matter if this fellow got his chest split open? He was nobody. He was no different from the Utes and Franks you take with your trusty axe when you're out impressing Magnus on his raids.
It is different."
Eivind was watching the crew as they began to drag the bull's bloody carcass forward to the place where they could most easily lift it over the side of the Knarr.
"This was a friend. At heart, a good man. And it seemed to me that I owed him something. Because of that business with Ragnar."
"Who?"
asked Somerled blankly. Eivind looked at him and looked away.
"Forget it," he said.
There was a doubt in his mind, a terrible, dark doubt that stretched not just over today's shocking events, but back into the distant past. His fingers touched the scar on his forearm, mark of an oath deep and binding, the promise of lifetime loyalty. He closed his eyes a moment and sent up a silent prayer to Thor.
"Let this not be true. Let me be wrong about him."
They cast the bull's body into the water, but Freya was not pleased. The wind changed, the rain began to descend in icy sheets, plastering the men's clothing to their skin and scouring the deck clean of blood. Ulf's intended course had been toward the setting sun, but it now became clear the god's angry breath was driving both vessels away from their true path, toward a region trackless and empty, where the dark waters held only the lurking terror of sea monsters and the sudden sharp grip of low-lying skerries. On the Knarr they manned the oars, but the current pulled so hard it threatened to rip the lengths of heavy pine from their hands, and the vessel plunged ahead on her own wild course. The passengers clung to ropes, to rails, to one another, to whatever they could find, shocked into a white-faced silence. Ahead of them, in the gloom of driving rain and ocean spray, the dark form of the golden dragon was barely visible above the turmoil of surging water. Eivind narrowed his eyes. He could scarcely see a ship length beyond the Gnar's prow. If Ulf had been right in his calculations, they must surely even now be passing their intended safe harbor, swept beyond it by the element's fury. It was as if day had become night. The storm had turned the world to darkness. He closed his eyes. "Thor," he spoke in silence, in the depths of the heart.
"Thor, I am your loyal son. I have served you with all my strength. Help us now, best of sailors. Show us the way."
"Land!"
someone shouted.
"I see land. Look, there to the south. And there to the north,"
yelled another man. Eivind's eyes snapped open. It was true. Now, dimly showing between the curtains of rain, a low, dark mass could be discerned. It was not so very far off, and yet it might have been at the other end of the world, so little chance there seemed of changing course to reach it. The ship followed her own will now. Another shape loomed farther away, and more again. Small islands, bigger islands, like a pod of whales rising in stately convoy from the ocean depths. The crew shouted to Ulf, "Land! Land!" But the gale snatched away their voices. They hauled on the oars anew, they wrestled with the sail. The angry waters were full of white spray, and the Knarr pitched and tossed, timbers groaning in protest. The golden dragon was a distant shadow in the grey ocean. Eivind gripped his oar, knuckles white. He looked up into the storm-split sky, and the rain fell hard and punishing onto his face.
I did not want to come here, Thor.
Surely the god must hear his warrior, even in this desolate corner of the world.
You know how it is for a fighting man. I obeyed my chieftain. I went where I was bid to go. But I am loyal. Guide us safely to shore, Warfather. Let us not come to grief on these skerries, nor be wrecked against these rocks. Bring us whole to landfall. We are your wolfskins, and will serve you while we have breath in our bodies. Save us for a noble death in battle, not a futile end, adrift without purpose. Thor, aid your sons.
He waited. If Thor did not help, he thought, then no god would. Odin was a trickster, clever and unpredictable. He was difficult to please, and his games were only for men who thrived on risks. Freyr had a temper. If one offended him, cataclysmic events might ensue, tempest, flood, drought, sudden maladies striking crops or men. With his power over the elements and seasons, Freyr could bestow plenty or famine. He appreciated a sacrifice, but even a fine bull might not be enough to calm his rage. Thor was different. Thor thought in terms any man could understand. Life and death, friend and foe, courage and cowardice. He rewarded loyalty and despised treachery. Thor understood a warrior's heart. The wind changed. Still, it blew fiercely, sending the boats fleeing before it like specks of foam on a flood-swollen stream. Yet now there seemed an eerie purpose behind it, for they were driven on a course that veered past small, flat islands and skirted the shores of larger ones, where signs of settlement showed in wandering sheep and the smoke from cottage fires. North they were driven, then south, then westward again, and the rain cleared, and it became apparent that this strange intervention of the gods had carried them through broad ocean firths into the very heart of this group of grass-clad isles. They had indeed reached the destination Ulf had intended for them, and now sailed westward into a sheltered bay in whose waters two small islands lifted low, grassy forms above the sea. These islets were fringed by spreading rock shelves, and here rested many seals, watching the visitors with mild, dark eyes. The land beyond the bay was gently sloping, green-clad and entirely without trees. This was perhaps the biggest island in the group. To the southwest, beyond the rolling hills, there was another isle where twin, dark, mysterious peaks loomed in forbidding grandeur. The crew rowed into the bay, the oars obeying them now, and dropped anchor. The golden dragon was beached on a narrow strip of pebbly shore. Ulf was the first to spring over the side. He fell to his knees on the wet ground and gave thanks to Odin, and Freyr, and Thor for their safe deliverance. It was a wondrous place. The waterway across which they had been driven was serene and bright now, and all marvelled at the changing colours of sky and sea, the cool, clear light that bathed these low green hills, the shimmering, pearly water. Birds circled their battered craft, perhaps hoping for fish. There were dwellings here, low houses of stone with heather-thatched roofs, but if any folk dwelt in them, they had fled at the sight of the two ships coming into shore. Supplies were unloaded, enough to last a few days, and the women and children settled as comfortably as possible. Ulf left guards. He instructed them that Lady Margaret was in charge. Then he set off inland with his men by him to determine what kind of place this was and who might hold sway here. It was indeed a fair land, with broad lakes and inlets and fine grazing pasture. Someone ran sheep and cattle. To Eivind's eye, the beasts looked well-tended and strong, though somewhat stocky in build. There were modest dwellings tucked here and there. Plumes of smoke rose from household fires. A good place, though curiously devoid of trees. The few they saw were clustered in sheltered folds of the land, like refugees of conflict. They speculated on this. There had been giants, maybe, who ripped them up like twigs, or fierce-toothed creatures that crunched them as easily as stalks of wheat. Perhaps the island had suffered a great fire, or maybe it was simply too windy. Those small birches and willows that clung here and there did have a somewhat prostrate look to them, as if accustomed to bow before some powerful force of nature.
"If I were to offer a gift to these people," Ulf remarked, "it would be timber for building, for they surely have a sore lack of it."
They came to a place of standing stones, set on a heather-cloaked rise by a neck of land which separated two wide expanses of bright water. In that place, all fell silent. The stones were tall. Even Eivind was dwarfed by them, and they were many. Holger tried to count them, but he ran out of numbers before he came around that great circle. More than 50, Ulf reckoned, and beyond them mounds in the earth, burial chambers perhaps, sealed by a blanket of turf. Sommerled remarked that such hidden places might just as readily conceal gold or silver than men's bones, and it was a shame there was no advantage to be had, in such a desolate corner of the world, from the sudden acquisition of such treasures. They did not stay long in that place. No priest had travelled with them, and there was no saying what ancient gods lingered there, or what they thought of unexpected visitors. They walked a long way, and never a living thing in sight but cows and sheep and a chicken or two. The wind got up and they began to feel the bite of it through cloaks and tunics still damp from the hard voyage.
"What are these people, some kind of ghosts, that they let us cross their land unchecked and themselves remain unseen?"
Håkon commented as they came up over a rise in the land and looked northward.
"We should return, perhaps, and stay by our womenfolk until we learn more."
"I think not," said Ulf in a strange tone.
And there, striding toward them across the grassy hillside, with grim purpose, was a group of men in tunics dyed blue or green or red. Men of small stature, dark-haired and armed with bows and staves.
"Well, well," observed Sommerled under his breath. "Genuine barbarians. I wonder if they'll introduce themselves before they start shooting. What tongue might we try, do you think? Latin? Frankish?"
But his brother ignored him. Stepping forward and raising his hands in a gesture that clearly denoted the wish to talk rather than fight, Ulf set about making his new world.
Chapter 5. If there was one day Nessa remembered from her childhood, it was the day when she found the tower in the earth. If she hadn't argued with Kinnart and gone off in a huff, it might never have happened, and her life might have been quite different. She'd been a very small girl then. Kinnart had made her so cross that she'd forgotten to be careful, and she'd wandered into a forbidden place, a place nobody walked across because it was brimful of magic. She'd gone without thinking, and suddenly there it was, a hole in the ground, hidden among the rocks beyond the low line of grass-crested dunes. If she hadn't been the sort of girl she was, one who liked adventures, she'd have been too scared to scrape away the earth and look in. But there was no doubt it was a spirit place, a place a good child would do well to keep clear of. Kinnart was down by the shore gutting their catch, gulls squabbling all around him, fighting for the scraps. The little skin boat was drawn up on the shingle close by. When she'd forgiven him, Nessa would go back. The strong westerly wind whipped her hair across her face, and she brushed it back impatiently. A little spade would be useful, a shard of bone, anything she could dig with. She scrabbled the earth away with small, capable hands. There was a bigger opening now, and the spring sunlight glanced in over her shoulder to show some sort of chamber there below, large, dry, lined with precisely laid slabs of stone and floored with earth. The hole was too small. She could not see properly. It almost looked as if the subterranean room opened down to another, but peer as she might, Nessa could not quite make it out. And the tide would be turning soon.
When you lived in a place like the Whaleback, you could not let disagreements delay you too long, or there would be no going home until lower water came around again. Perhaps it would rain. This secret place had been sealed against the weather a long time, until the violent storms of the season's turning had begun to uncover it. She bent to shift a slab of flagstone to drag it across the opening she had widened. Another time. There was plenty of time. Summer was on the way, and the days were light and long. Maybe she'd tell Kinnart, and maybe not. If he stopped teasing her about how she made up names for things, if he stopped saying she'd never find a husband, then she'd show her cousin the place she had discovered. Who wanted a husband anyway? One of her sisters could find one and produce the son required to secure the kingship. Her sisters were older and prettier and quite good at sewing and baking bread. They couldn't fish and they couldn't row, and they couldn't run or climb or swim as well as Nessa could. Kinnart said husbands cared nothing for those sorts of skills. It was other things they wanted. What things? Nessa had asked him. But when he told her, she thought he must be joking. There were two ways to get home to the Whaleback. When they had the boat, they could row back to the Hidden Cove, no more than a slit in the tidal island's rocky southern flank, clamber precariously out and drag their small craft up to a little hollow above high water. Then they'd climb farther, till they reached the curving grassy top of the Whaleback, and run downhill to the houses that clustered low at the eastern end, perched on the level ground overlooking the causeway. If you'd gone over to the mainland on foot, there was but a single way to return, and that was over the same causeway, picking a careful path on the weed-draped stones. They knew the tides as they knew the patterns of their own breath. In summer there was time, before and after the lowest ebb, to walk a fair way up or down the coast, or inland across the home farms to check on stock or visit neighbours. A journey farther afield meant a longer stay, for once the rising sea came close to washing over that central pathway, there was no crossing over, not unless you fancied a life among the mackerel and the selkies. In times of winter storm, sometimes there was no way over for days on end, for the winds howled fiercely, and the water whipped sideways through the gap between brook and shore. And there was no corner of the Whaleback left untouched by the icy spray of the western sea. The sky was a lowering cloak of darkness. Gulls were tossed helpless on the wind. In winter, a stranger might have wondered that the folk had named their home the Light Isles. Was not this a realm of endless freezing darkness, visited by hellish winds, pounded by nightmare seas, a stark, empty place where scarcely a tree dared lift its branches from the earth to soften the bleak landscape? Then spring would come, and if the stranger had waited, he would understand all at once why those who dwelt here knew it for the loveliest place on earth. Here the sky held more colours than there were blades of grass on the hillsides. Here the sea was endlessly changing, moody, bountiful, capricious, a shawl of mystery wrapping these fair islands with its fluid touch. Each stone bore its own story, each shell its own pattern, each flower its enchantment. When you sat on the clifftops in springtime, the air was alive with the calls of birds. Puffins and gulls jostled for space on the ledges and spread their wings to the wind, soaring and gliding. Ahead of you was an ocean that had no ending. Behind you, the low, sweet hills rolled away to shining lakes. To the south, in the distance, was High Island with its twin mountains, a place of hidden valleys and monstrous rock stacks, a realm best fit for fishermen and priests. There were old things in the Light Isles. The folk had dwelt here many generations, but there were others, beings of earth and of ocean, embodiments of light and water, presences of bone and darkness, whose claim was ancient and undeniable. These creatures must be respected if one were to share the land in relative peace. The folk had always known that. At 6 years old, Nessa knew it, even as she'd known that to look into their secret places, like the chamber she'd discovered under the earth, was to court trouble. So, before she left, she placed a pattern in small stones atop the covering slab, a sign of acknowledgement. She hoped they would understand, whoever they were. The four stones at the corners were for the four quarters. In the middle, pebbles made a wavy line. That was the sea. and above it, round sun, crescent moon. Thus she told them she knew what sort of place it was, and held it in respect. If there was anything the folk understood, it was the importance of signs. Nessa rose to her feet and turned, and there was the old woman, not 3 paces away, staring at her with eyes like grey pebbles. Nessa's heart pounded in shock, but she could not run away, for it felt as if her feet had grown sudden roots, holding her there to the earth.
"Come closer, child," the old woman said. "My sight is not what it was."
Now the ground released its grip and she could move. She stepped toward the ragged figure. The woman's grey plait hung down to her waist, her features were seamed and creviced like old stone. And Nessa knew who she was, because Nessa had always loved stories.
"Rona," she whispered. "The wise woman. I told Kinnart you were real, but he wouldn't believe me."
The old woman gave a grunt of amusement.
"What is real?" she asked. "Is music real? Is shadow real? Your cousin is a boy. He knows only what he can see, what he can touch. For you and me, it is different."
"You and me?"
Nessa was staring. She was not afraid anymore. Rona, the priestess, keeper of the mysteries, was another tale like the sealed tribe and the hidden tribe, as much part of the islands as the tides and the wind, the rocks and the heather. It seemed entirely unsurprising that she had appeared here, by the secret chamber in the earth.
"I've been waiting for you," Rona said.
"Waiting?"
"Waiting for you to be ready."
The old woman glanced at the sign Nessa had made on the slab of stone.
"I see that you are ready now."
It came to Nessa then that she did not need to ask, ready for what. She knew the answer without being told.
"Every day," Rona said, "there's a great deal for you to learn. Every day at low tide. You can go home in between."
"I'll have to ask Uncle Angus's permission," Nessa told her. "And my mother's."
The old woman smiled.
"You're the youngest of 3, aren't you? Angus doesn't need you to wed and breed. And your uncle's no fool, for all he's a man. He knows the importance of the ancestors. He understands the need for the rituals to be performed properly after I'm gone. Tell him what I've said. He will let you come and learn."
Nessa nodded.
"I'd better go now," she said. "The tide's on the turn, and Kinnart will be looking for me."
"Tomorrow," said Rona gravely. "Your cousin must learn to fish alone now."
That day had been her turning point, Nessa thought, as she picked her way across the narrow path of tumbled stones to the safety of the whaleback on a fine, gusty spring day. If she had not run without caution into the dunes all those years ago, she might by now have been betrothed to some chieftain of the Cat, married even. Uncle Angus was cautiously negotiating good matches for her sisters, but she'd escaped that, thanks to Rona. Her path would be different. For 10 years now, she had learned what the wise woman had to teach her. For 10 years, she had practiced and perfected the rituals of sun and moon, earth and ocean. She had grown up in the knowledge of things seen and unseen, in the reverence and understanding of the old ways. These patterns were eternal. Without them, the folk could not survive. Soon she would leave the whaleback and King Angus's household and dwell alone in the place of the mysteries, as Rona did. The folk would see her from time to time, for on certain days of the year the women of the island gathered to reverence the earth and the moon, and on other days the men acknowledged the life-giving force of the sun, the power of the ocean. It would be her part, in time, to make sure these rituals were conducted properly, When that happened, she would become like Rona herself, a being regarded as not quite real, poised between flesh and spirit, woman and wraith. That would be strange indeed. Nessa came up the bank to the level grassy ground of the settlement. The household was much reduced in numbers, for Uncle Angus had gone away with many of his men. There had been a report of strange vessels sailing into Silver Bay, and folk with hair the colour of ripe barley coming ashore, armed with many weapons. Angus had taken a party of warriors and travelled south. Perhaps the unexpected arrivals hailed from the land of the cat, and would demand some token of fealty. Angus was used to that, since it happened every few years. What one did, Nessa had learned, was to give a few gifts and pass a few compliments, and they'd go away again, thinking you'd agreed to something. Most likely this was the same business again. Yet the description of the stranger's ships did not match anything seen before in these waters. Angus would surely have a tale to tell on his return. It was quiet with the men gone. Still, the evening would not be without entertainment, for Brother Tige was here. Everyone remembered the boat that he had arrived in with three others of his kind, all the way from some distant place called Ulster. Nobody believed, at first, that a tiny craft of wattles and skins, with the merest scrap of sail, could carry men safely across the sea to land them, ragged, thirsty, and windblown, on the sandy beach at South Bay. Fishermen there said the brothers had knelt down on the shore with the wavelets lapping around their long robes, and uttered some sort of prayer, and then had walked calmly over and introduced themselves. Not that anyone there had understood their speech. That came later. Nessa had asked Brother Tige about the voyage, and he told her God's hand had guarded the boat, and held back the waves and the storms and the sea serpents, to bring his children to safe haven. They were crazy men, but harmless. Their madness showed not only in the folly of their voyage and the blind trust that inspired it, but in the home they chose once they arrived. Angus had offered them a house and a patch of land, well sheltered from the wind and bordered by sweet pasture. But they chose a spot long uninhabited by humankind, an isle whipped on either side by a violent tide race, a low-lying, windswept place. There were enough tales about that island to keep any man in his right mind well away. Disappearances, strange lights, mists, and shadows. Everyone knew the place belonged to the Seal Tribe, a race ancient, elusive, and deeply dangerous. The brothers sailed their rickety boat across and began to build a dwelling house, a prayer house, a sheep pen, a chicken coop. From that day on, the folk began to call it Holy Island. The brothers did not beg. They did not ask for help. Their small community grew slowly, one or two more, drifting in to the shore as the first had done, in scrappy boats hardly fit for lakeshore fishing. A couple of the local lads had gone over to Holy Island to offer help with shifting stones or shearing sheep, and stayed to work and to learn. In time, there were eight on the island, and seven of them kept themselves. The exception was Tige. He had learned the tongue of the folk with remarkable speed, and was now a frequent visitor in most parts of the islands. Indeed, he knew many languages, having travelled widely as a younger man, and lived among many kinds of folk. He delighted in teaching what he knew. Nessa, an eager student, could now keep up a passable conversation in basic Latin, and a better one in Norse. Others of her people dismissed such knowledge. When were they ever likely to need it? But, Nessa said, all knowledge is precious, and Tige agreed with her. Everyone made Tige welcome, for he told wonderful stories, and while the brother never asked for food or fishing line or a length of woolen cloth, he never went home without a full satchel, for folk had not forgotten his feat of navigation. They admired his courage, even as they recognized the folly of his voyage. When he came to the whaleback, Tige would sit in his usual place on a bench near the fire, his half-shaven head shining pink in the glow of the flames. All the brothers adopted the same odd style, with the front part of the skull bald as an egg. This tonsure was the way of their brotherhood, Tige had explained, though there was another kind, where just a circle on top of the head was shaved. It had been the cause of much dispute among the adherents to their faith, almost as much as the method of calculating the right day of the year for the holy feast of spring, which he called Easter.